Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you, this is your first time, we welcome you as well. Well, you can see I'm back. That last Sunday show was not my last show. I want to start by saying something about that. I was like sharing some reflections, and maybe I left the total impression that last week was possibly my last show, and I had to go and do some introspection and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I caught hell for that. My team that makes up the War Report, they were all over me like, what did you mean? You never told us. And other people were writing me and contacting me, and so I'm going to apologize. What I said was true. I needed to reflect on some things, and yes, I had picked my first year anniversary at the end of my first year to reflect on how it had turned out, what I needed to do going forward, and on and on and on. And I did not intend to leave the impression that I may not be back this week or any other time. I wouldn't do that, at least not consciously. I would have probably just had a show just on my leaving so I could explain it in detail and all those things that I feel I should do when that period comes. What I was kind of talking about was that, you know, when you get to a certain age, you start thinking about a bucket list, the things that you want to do before you kick the bucket. And I'm at that age, and I have a bucket list, and every item in my bucket list deals with fighting till I die, trying to protect, defend, save public education, and defeat all of our foes. That's my thing. You can put it in a cup as opposed to a bucket, because everything that I'm doing, everything I've been doing for the last, I don't know how many years, and almost my entire life, has been in total support of a quality public education system, pre-K to PhD. I have different things that I want to do. The show is very much integral to almost everything I want to do. But the other things will require a lot of time and effort from me, and that's what I was reflecting on, is whether or not can I start another project out of my bucket list and also do the show? Do I modify my role in the show? All the things, whatever options that I could come up with. So that's what I meant. I'm back. In fact, we're now back weekly. Every Sunday, 2 o'clock, we're here. No more every other Sunday. No more Sunday from 2 to 4. This is our home. This is our time slot, Sundays from 2 to 3. Now, so, hopefully I made amends, and I probably am not out of trouble with some people, but that's my shot. Today, we have another in a long line of esteemed guests to tell us about some very important things. I almost said it what it was, but I decided not to. So I'm going to get right to her. Her name is Gia Lee. Many of you will already know about her. She took the nation by storm a few weeks ago when she appeared before the Senate Hearing Commission on Education, and it just electrified the ed community. So with that, I'm going to introduce you to Gia. Hi, Gia. Would you come in, please?
Hi. Hi, James. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you know, it's more than my pleasure that you said yes and all. Well, it's been, what, 3 weeks, 4 weeks?
Oh, yeah. I mean, time's just flown. But it seems like just yesterday.
Okay. Before we get into that, why don't you tell the audience something about you, like a brief snapshot of your bio?
Sure. Currently, I'm a fourth and fifth grade teacher at the Earth School in the East Village here in New York City. It's snowing right now. It's probably one of the coldest winters that I can remember here. I've been with the DOE for about 13, 14 years, and mostly as a special education teacher. I guess I came in right at the advent of No Child Left Behind. So it's all I've ever known. I've kind of watched it grow, morph, and seen different perspectives around the issues and how it's played out in our schools here. I'm also a parent of an 11-year-old. He is in the sixth grade at a wonderful middle school in our neighborhood with the same elementary school that I teach at, which is very convenient. He loves to dance, and I'm very fortunate to be living in a city that affords students still some opportunities. They're dwindling, but opportunities for the arts and other programs. So that's kind of, you know, where I'm at right now. I'm originally from Southern California, where you're at right now, so I'm missing the warm weather.
Eat your heart out. I mean, I didn't say that, did I? Okay. Now, before you make your appearance before the Senate, what was life like for you then, the day-to-day routine?
Well, you know, people who know me kind of say that, you know, I do too much as it is. I think that in the past 3 years, what my life has been like is realizing and trying to harness, you know, the power within each of us. And, you know, I'm trying to set myself up to kind of, you know, when you talk about your bucket list, you know, or, you know, it's a cup, I see it as trying to have everybody kind of pour into the same bucket and make it grow so that we can have this huge bucket that kind of overflows and so that we can see a place of change, actual change, instead of, you know, a grumbling, mumbling about what's not happening. So, you know, I spend the entire day, you know, during the week, just, you know, with my students. You know, teachers all know we take our work home. We are working constantly to kind of refine our craft, you know, use what we know about our students, and, you know, create really meaningful kind of, you know, activities and learning opportunities. So, you know, a lot of our time is spent on that. So taking on this full-time activism has also added a layer, not only that, but being a parent and trying to, you know, balance and juggle all of this. So the more people I see, you know, joining the bandwagon, and, you know, I say bandwagon, but it's really joining forces and kind of, you know, feeling empowered themselves, I find that the work is becoming very rich and deep in so many different ways. Conversations that I've had with people each day around these issues are not just about public education. It's more than that, right? It's about building community. So, you know, that's what my days are. I've been meeting people I don't think I would ever otherwise come across, even on social media, connecting with folks I would never have dreamed of meeting and just being really impacted in wonderful ways. So that's been my day-to-day life. And even afterwards, I think it just, after the Senate hearing, it's just gotten exponentially more in terms of, you know, the kind of connections with other people. So, you know, if anything, any positive we can say that's coming out of these horrible policies is that it's bringing people together. So I kind of hold on to that.
So before the Senate hearing, and the reason I'm starting at that point, before the hearings and then the after, like the life cycle of all of this, when did you become aware that you were, and all the rest of the teachers and the children, were in a war? And I'm assuming that you share my metaphor that this is a war.
Yes, you know, absolutely. So when I started teaching in what here in New York City is called District 75, is a special education district. And like I said, I came into the, you know, public school teaching right when No Child Left Behind started. So as a science teacher in a high school for students who are in and out of incarceration, and struggling, you know, social, emotionally, and, you know, environmentally, just to meet their basic needs, I found that the policies of these students having to take Regents exams and other, you know, types of kind of like compliance-based standardized curriculum wasn't meeting their needs. They were in a very different place in terms of what their needs were. So, you know, right then I knew something was awry. I started, you know, doing some studying on the school-to-prison pipeline, even in my first year of teaching. As the years progressed, you know, I started teaching at an elementary school. And that's, you know, Joel Klein became our chancellor here in New York City. We, at the elementary school that I taught at, had a principal come in from the Leadership Academy. This principal used practices that were quite, you know, it was kind of a shock to the system for the staff because we were used to working collaboratively, reflecting on our practice, you know, and talking about our students in ways that were about, you know, how to impact our teaching. But with this new administration, we learned quickly that it was much more about compliance and adhering to very scripted curricula. I mean, we were timed. We were observed and kind of scrutinized and micromanaged is really the word. And I think that a lot of teachers in New York and in other places can agree, like there's a pattern here with the kind of management style that was being used in our schools. And what we know about our profession is that you need collaboration. And even in the business world, it's through collaboration and kind of, you know, having autonomy that we're able to do our work with our students. So this kind of compliance-based system that I was living in meant that there were seasoned teachers, veteran teachers, you know, 25, 30 years, who suddenly were being harassed. And, you know, I use that word in a very real way, harassed, in terms of getting having observations and you know, changes in placements even. So, for example, there was a teacher who had been working as a pull-out set teacher, support teacher, and suddenly was placed into the classroom and then observed weekly and written up with very negative comments and observations weekly, on a weekly basis. This took such a toll on this person who had dedicated most of her life in the New York City, you know, Department of Education, that I said something is really wrong. If we can't find a way to communicate and support, you know, this person, and it wasn't just her, what is this about? What is this really about? Because if this teacher is under so much stress, how is that impacting the children that she's working with? She was often found in tears in the, during, you know, in the middle of the classroom. I'm like, do parents know that this is happening? But because of this climate of fear, and I learned quickly that it wasn't just our school. This is, you know, this was kind of rampant in our system here in New York City. that people were just staying quiet, trying to keep under the radar. They did not want to be known. There was almost like a feeling of shame. But once we started to come together, people started expressing what was happening. You know, this was amongst staff. I said, you know what, let me go talk to our administrator. Let's go meet with her and find out. At that point, our chapter leader, which is the name of our union representative at the school here in New York City, she was also pushed out and put into what used to be called like the rubber room because of her advocacy at our school. But we didn't realize that because, you know, we just didn't expect, you know, we're always trying to assume good intentions. Didn't expect that to happen. We weren't prepared for that. So we didn't have any kind of representation. I kind of, you know, stepped up and said, all right, let's have a talk. And I quickly realized that this person did not, this administrator did not want me to speak up, found it threatening. But we started forming a consultation committee. That's where teachers come together and kind of have a very diplomatic meeting with the administrator around issues. I quickly found that this divide and conquer method within our school was quickly killing the morale. People who were trying to advocate for themselves felt that even our consultation committee work was not working. I started getting targeted, you know, targeted because of my advocacy in the school. Parents were even writing letters on behalf of staff members when it came down to disciplinary type accusations. It was just something that we had never expected and wasn't prepared for, and I found out that we weren't the only ones. As a single mother, you know, taking care of a young child at the time, he was about 5, 6 years old, I was taking this on. I felt it wasn't a healthy environment. Quickly found that there were other schools in our city that had cultures of collaboration, and I just was looking for a way out. Just like you see many teachers kind of leaving the profession, I was looking for someplace else. And I found, you know, I told myself, if I don't find a school environment that is healthy and, you know, a place where people work together, I might have to leave the Department of Education. And that the thought was just, you know, horrifying to me, but I felt like I was being pushed against the wall. So then I started teaching at the art school, and what I experienced was just amazing. And I said, if this is possible here, the kind of collaboration and culture of trust and collegiality, don't get me wrong, you know, we have our disagreements, but we have a system of good democratic decision-making. I was like, this is what can happen in other schools, and this is what should be happening in other schools. And that's kind of when I, you know, took on this activism. I have to add that I watched, and everyone listening, if you haven't already watched, The Inconvenient Truth about Waiting for Superman. That's the entire title. It was a documentary that was made by New York City Public School teachers about what was happening. I connected with it immediately. It's free online. It's a Vimeo. And after watching that, I realized there were other people. I reached out to them. They got back to me right away, and we formed a caucus within our union, the Movement of Rank and File Educators, through which we support, you know, created a support network. And also I joined a group that formed out of this also parent group called Change the Stakes. I joined other parents around advocating, you know, parents need to know. That was a big question. Why aren't the parents informed about how these policies are affecting their children? So, I mean, that's where it all kind of started. I know it's long, but I definitely, you know, have to say that started off just like everybody else, just kind of trying to survive in the system, and found that there were others. And once I connected, I felt empowered. So, yeah, that's kind of my backstory.
And I think you said it's kind of long, but that's what the War Report affords all of our guests, an opportunity to go beyond a 30-second soundbite or 2.5-minute clip on mm-hmm. the news or what have you. And this is your platform, and you're utilizing it beautifully. You touched on so many different topics. Let me just mm-hmm. quickly say, you know, we did School to Prison Pipeline last week.
Yeah.
I'm going to revisit that a little later on, and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to call you and ask you to be part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what you didn't know is I'm going to do a rubber room there, and then here in Los Angeles, it's teacher jail. I'm going to do a bi-coastal program talking to people who had experience there in New York in the rubber room and people who know about the teacher jail here in California and how people get pushed into those programs and the outcomes. So you just got yourself another invitation for another program if you're up for it. So you got two going for you now. Let's move now to you brought us up to before your committee appearance. How were you selected for the committee to appear before the committee?
So,
and the reason I'm asking, the reason I'm asking that is that you got selected to appear and I didn't, and I want to know what the hell happened.
Well, I have to tell you, your experience is probably, you know, maybe what kind of kept you, but, you know, in terms of the longevity you've had in the system. I also have to say that they were looking for a current public school teacher, and I happened to co-authored and written with others around the, you know, we have a website now. It's called teachersofconscience.wordpress, but we wrote a position paper and a letter to our chancellor stating, you know, in very, you know, research-backed, our convictions and taking a principled stance against the administering of the state standardized test here in New York. With that letter, we received some publicity. Through that, somebody sent my information to the secretary of one of the Senate representatives at Senator Alexander Lamar's office. I received a call from his representative about 2 weeks prior to the hearing. He interviewed me on the phone with another representative from a Democratic senator's office. They said that they would be interviewing other public school teachers around the nation. They would get back to me. And I was very honest on the phone about what I knew about the use of standardized testing and the detrimental ways that they were having an impact on our students and, you know, just the larger society. Then they called me back, and this time it was four representatives, two Democratic, two Republican representatives, who kind of grilled me on the phone again, asking me questions about the role of high-stakes standardized testing with students with special needs, English language learners, and, you know, again, I was very honest, and I didn't think I'd get picked. I really didn't think that they would choose me, but then, you know, about a week before the hearing, I received an email that was a formal invitation to the Senate hearing. I scrambled to, you know, make sense of it and kind of prepare my statement. But yeah, that was kind of the process that I underwent.
Okay. I saw your appearance. So many of us did. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. I played it just a few minutes before we came on air and all. After that, actually during the appearance itself, when it made the news and they made the TV shows, the clips and what have you, when it went viral pretty much, what was the impact, immediate impact on you?
Well, it was, I can say it was like a very overwhelming effect. People who, you know, friends of mine who'd, you know, never really talked to me about these issues, you know, especially in California, I have a lot of friends that I grew up with, who have children now in the California public school system. And we would touch on it, but they didn't quite you know, they were still grappling with what was happening with the Common Core and what was happening across the nation, and I would try to bring it up. They suddenly were, you know, chiming in and writing to me, calling me, wanting to find out more. That from that end, you know, that was very, very, it was thrilling to make that connection. But I think that for a little while, people were thinking, you know, I'm just very radical and, you know, taking it too far, Gia with her, you know, kind of extreme ideas about what's going on. You know, the powers that be must know what they're doing, right? Was kind of the impetus. I'm the only public school teacher amongst, you know, my circle of friends. Then the largest impact was the connection I mentioned earlier with folks in different states and different communities across New York who wrote to me, reached out to me and said, how can I be a teacher of conscience? I feel like I'm the only one here in my community, or, you know, what strategies, what, you know, what are the things I can do to take this step? Because I just read the test administrator's manual for, you know, this test coming up, and I can't stomach it. I cannot give this to my students. What can I do? So it became a lot more apparent that there are teachers out there who are feeling so strongly opposed to the way that these tests are being used. They're ready. They're ready to take a stand. So, you know, we developed a toolkit of sorts. I just, you know, created with, you know, along with some other people who have taken a similar stance, and I just shared it with a bunch of people who contacted me. And it has, you know, things like a checklist, a calendar of things to do to prepare, literature. And if people aren't ready to take that, you know, take that leap into being a conscientious objector, there are options, you know, things like creating or crafting a resolution against high stakes testing. There have been several already written by entire and signed on to by an entire staff. There's also petitions. There have been just teachers putting up Michelle Gunderson, you know, who's from Chicago. Chicago's Teachers Union wrote the pledge for the ethical use of student data. It's a very neat thing that you can post just on your wall. It's like, I, as a teacher, will view my students. I'll be a student-driven teacher, not a data-driven teacher. You know, just things like that so that people feel empowered to take that step. So I think that's those connections and being able to share strategies and resources with folks to take that step rather than, you know, feeling like they have to run. I just want to mention that I think people are in fight or flight mode, and people want to be able to take a firm stand and be assertive, find that middle ground and not necessarily fight and get into, you know, really oppositional type situations, but to take a firm stand and find a way to do it that is principled and strong. And if we do that in mass, I think that that's a powerful statement.
That was very well put, because you hit on several things. One of the things that I want to do now is, mm-hmm. let's go over your Senate testimony. I know you've done many interviews since you did had your testimony, but I think if we could pull some of the questions that you have answered already to some extent, it would be probably very informative for those who did not see your performance and would mm-hmm. give us a chance to create a big picture for other people to hear. Okay. What do you think of that?
Sure.
Okay. As I said, I know you have done an interview, but I have one question before we get to that structure that mm-hmm. if I don't get in, I will be in deep, deep trouble. A teacher in Connecticut named Jo Lieb, some time ago she wrote a piece, and I pulled mm-hmm. a question that I think was the essence of her story. And it's pretty much like, when it's all about the kids, Mm-hmm. When that becomes do no harm, have we created a failing national school system? Let me make sure I stated that correctly. All the people who are pushing the corporate war, they all say, it's all about the children. It's all about the children. That translates, and when they implement their programs, it becomes, all about the children becomes do no harm. You guys are harming our children with your program. Mm-hmm. And the further we go along with all about the children and its intended effects, I said intended effects, we are creating, are we creating a national system mm-hmm. that builds in failure? And the question is, would you agree with that or disagree?
That, so the question, can you repeat the question one more time, because I want to make sure
when
I have
we
it.
Put, when the reformers say that it's all about the children,
right.
It's all about the children. When it's all about the children, when that becomes do no harm, mm-hmm. have we created a failing national school system?
Hmm.
Let me see if I can do a better job on this. They say our school system is failing, and okay. they intervene.
Right.
And in their intervention, they say, what we're doing is all about the children.
Right. Okay, I see what you're saying. Okay, so, you know, that's interesting that they would label schools as failing, first of all, right? It's the same kind of, you know, create a crisis so that we can propose a fix-it solution. We're the fixers, right? I think that that kind of mindset sets us up for whatever, you know, product they have to sell, whatever, you know, solutions that they have that are not based in any kind of truth, but in some based more on whatever agenda they have, which clearly is, you know, to move towards a privatization. So to buy into the rhetoric of failing schools when it's completely false, I think is, you know, it's dangerous, you know, to start. But when you look at, you know, we can look at the numbers, we can look at the statistics and see that, you know, in more affluent communities, based on tests, you know, the scores of the tests, the children in more affluent communities do very well. Are those schools failures? I don't think so. And that's why I think that we see such, you know, high mobilization in the more affluent communities right now in terms of the opt-out movement, where what we have is considered failing schools where there are low test scores are in the poorer communities. And those children basically are not in failing schools. They're in a failing system of that is more indicative of what's going on in society, right? Those test scores are more indicative of lack of access to resources. Their basic needs aren't being met. How can they be ready for learning? Right. And the schools are doing the most that they can. But yet the schools in the big urban pockets have interesting, you know, budgets and ways of working with school budgets. They're stripped. The last few years, they just have seen less per pupil spending than ever. And so the solutions shouldn't be so narrowly thought of. I think that to label the schools as part of a bigger agenda that we all know is, you know, about privatization, about privatizing off to our children. And that's where I say, you know, now you're harming our kids. You're giving them a one-size-fits-all, and you're ensuring that you're creating a class of students who have a very hard time thinking outside of right or wrong in terms of their way of thinking.
Gia, we have a caller.
Excellent.
Yes. Caller?
Yes. Hello?
I want to preface this call, Gia. I was going to sort of like redo the interviews, some of the interviews that you've done before.
Mm-hmm.
And there was sort of like a palace coup. I was dethroned. And I was told that if I don't relinquish my hostship for this part of the interview, I face imminent rubber room or teacher jail or whatever, what have you. And so I'm a coward. I'm relenting. And I'm going to ask the caller to do an interview so that I can sleep safely tonight without having to worry. Caller, would you introduce yourself?
Yes. Hello, Gia. This is Luciana Sampson. How are you doing?
Hi, Luciana. Great. Great to hear your voice.
It's really good to hear your voice as well. For those of you that are listening, my name is Luciana Sampson, and I am part of the War Report team, and I work with Dr. Miller, and I work with Joe Lieb, and we are Team War Report, and we are responsible for basically helping Dr. Miller put together his show and trying to get all of our ducks in a row and make sure that we have fabulous guests like Gia. And I'm also a public school teacher, and I teach English language arts to all seniors at a public school in Tennessee at a small rural school, and I also teach AP literature. And Gia and I, we actually met through a mutual contact, Michael Elliott, who ironically is releasing his second documentary right now about the Park exam in New Jersey. And he is also who followed you to D.C. and filmed a short documentary about you and your hearing with with Senator Alexander. And so Michael, being my contact, someone that I know, contacted me and told me about his documentary with you. And then I, being me, the networking guru that I am, contacted you. We had a nice conversation, and you gave me an exclusive interview, which we published on Anthony Cody's Living in Dialogue in conjunction with the War Report, which was very kind of you. Thank you. So I am... you so that we can talk about
Lucy, we're losing you.
You're losing me? Let me move. My signal is bad. How is that? Is that any better?
That's much better. Much better.
Okay, great. Great. I just thought I would call in and I would re-interview you, Gia, if that's okay with you, and we can talk a little bit about your process with Teachers of Conscience and how you got to that point, and we can talk about other things as well. So, surprise!
Yay, sounds great.
This is awesome.
I didn't have any choice in this, so I'm not saying anything.
Well, first of all,
I'm
would
so
like
happy
to, say,
to talk to both of you.
I know, it's great. It's like long-lost compadres reunited.
I know.
Gia, you said something in your interview that really stuck to me. And this is a direct quotation. You said, "Remember that fear is natural, but there is greater fear in knowing what will happen if we don't take a stand."
Right.
And to me, that was the most powerful quotation or quote from your interview, and I use that to sort of preface what I asked you. And I'm just going to go over some of these things briefly. So I know that Dr. Miller has covered a few of these questions, but if you'll just tell me, what has been the public reaction as of now, where you are now that all of this has kind of died down a little bit, or has it died down a little bit? I know that there are more teachers that are sort of coming to you daily. What's it like to be you on a daily basis? Can you sort of walk us through the life of Gia?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I probably am representative of, you know, how most teachers are feeling, and I'm doing what most teachers feel that they want to do or are ready to do. There have been, you know, numerous instances where, so now, for instance, I've been asked to speak at a few forums upstate or in Long Island, and to speak to other people. I've been asked to speak here in the city. I am also aware that, you know, for some people, they're scared. They're afraid of me. My own union leadership is afraid of me, I think. They don't quite understand, you know, how what I'm saying is speaking truth to power. That
right.
This is what the teachers who are rank and file are asking for. So I do get some, you know, kind of pushback, not necessarily in any real, you know, outward way from the union leadership, but they certainly won't give me or teachers like myself the platform to speak against the high-stakes testing in terms of their alignment with the Common Core and things like that. And that is really problematic. So for me, you know, like, to be me, it's like knowing something bad's going to happen and people aren't listening, right? The people that
right.
actually make the decisions aren't listening. It's kind of frustrating. Yes, there have been news reporters that contact me and also, you know, ask me to speak on, you know, different shows as well. But I feel like the work that I need to do is, you know, grassroots. It's on the ground. It's in the schools. It's with other teachers and other parents. So I've spent, you know, a lot of my time in the past few weeks since I got back just meeting with people. And that's kind of what it's been like. And now folks who live, you know, in different, like Port Jefferson, I'm going to be at in Long Island next Saturday. They've made me their keynote speaker, and I know that depending on the community, there are different concerns. People need to feel that they're heard. There's a lot of fear. There are a lot of threats coming down. They need to understand that there's power in their collectiveness, in their communities.
Right.
So I'm hoping that my role is just to kind of be that voice of, I know what you're afraid of. I know that this is what you're feeling, but you can do this. And there are ways to do it.
Right.
And here are some ideas. Here are some strategies. And just kind of help people feel empowered.
That's excellent. And what you said about the union involvement and the lack thereof
right.
and the support for you and or the lack thereof, that's a huge issue for
mm-hmm.
all of us. And
yep.
they are really, because they took the blood money, so to speak, and I mean, I'm
mm-hmm.
association. I'm a local association president. I'm union. You know, I mean, not... I'm a member of NEA and TEA and FCEA,
mm-hmm.
and we're an association. Tennessee's a red state. But
mm-hmm.
because of taking the Common Core money and voting
mm-hmm.
along those lines, the unions have managed to really tie their hands.
Yep.
And so it seems to me that they're definitely afraid because they have bought themselves or sold themselves, essentially. They're
right.
afraid to really act. And so it's almost, and, you know, let me know if you feel the same way, I almost feel like the unions are looking to their grassroots members to do all of this heavy lifting while simultaneously agreeing with their platform.
Mm-hmm. That's,
and that is
that's
very,
absolutely
that's very
true.
Troublesome. And then
yep.
if you don't back them, then they will discredit you while expecting
mm-hmm.
you to still be union strong. And that,
right.
I think, is where so much of the fear comes from and why
mm-hmm.
so many teachers don't support each other and turn on each other because they
right.
want that power.
Right.
And that's a real problem. Do you agree with that?
It's huge. Absolutely. It's a huge problem here in New York City. You know, the locals upstate here, the union leaders are all teachers. They actually work. They teach. Because New York
right.
City is so
in
huge,
here.
Our leadership is a bureaucracy in and of itself. Their interests are in maintaining power. Make sure that they have a seat at the table. Well, when, you know,
right.
This was something that Karen Lewis, she was the teacher union president in Chicago, she said, you don't have a seat at the table when you're on the menu, when you're what's up for lunch, you know, dinner. That is a complete farce to think that you actually have some kind of negotiating power. I just want to put out there that here in New York City, our own union leadership, when, you know, charter schools were first being kind of proposed, created their own charter. As of this past week, there was an announcement made that they are now eliminating the lower grades. It's basically getting dismantled. There were people back then, like, you know, I don't know how many years ago, 10, 15 years ago, who said it wasn't right. It wasn't, you know, creating co-located situations in schools causes a system of competition. And when you do that,
right,
you have, you know, all kinds of problems, especially when your success and your CEOs, they have no experience in education. So what are they looking at? Test scores to basically
right.
determine the value of your work, right? Totally invalid.
Right.
And yet our own leadership went along with it. And now they're seeing the consequences of them not listening to their rank and file.
Right.
Instead of doing their job and helping us to organize, it's almost like they've lost the ability or they've lost that institutional memory of how unions work, how to organize and how to be really ground up instead of top down.
That's
a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. That top down leadership mentality, and of course, there's a lot of money at the top.
Exactly.
And so, you know, it's a huge problem. So what are we going to do? What's the solution here? How do we go about rebuilding our unions so that they listen to the rank and file rather than signing some type of blood oath, which
right.
only destroys the rank and file if they don't go along with the top?
Right. Well,
what is the solution?
I think that we have to come together with the solutions, and people who have been so used to, and I'm just as guilty, you know, when I first started teaching, I kind of went along because there is no training in our union for how to be a unionist. Like, I didn't know how our district reps were selected. I found out just a couple years ago that even our district representatives they're basically appointed. They used to be an elected position. That's problematic. So there are certain key aspects of how things function and how things work that need to change in terms of having elected officials within our union who should be, but they don't, facilitate meetings where there's discussion. I've gone to several of our chapter meetings where our district representative basically feeds us the information and we are there to ask questions for clarifying. It's not a discussion. There is no collective decision-making.
Let me clarify. Are you speaking about AFT or NEA?
I'm speaking about within our UFT. And I see it happening at the, you know, I went to my first ever AFT conference. What I saw there is very similar. There are tactics I've seen used there to kind of bully, you know, between caucuses or between groups to kind of push an agenda.
Excuse me, let me come in and say that we have 5 minutes left. And,
oh, wow.
Gia, I wanted you to get to teachers of consciousness.
Okay.
That is, explain what that is and what you guys are trying to do. How you are you growing? Teachers coming to you by the grows, or it's a trickle, or what? Just give us a quick...
I would say, sure. Teachers are definitely coming to us through our website. There's also West Coast. There's a letters of... I forgot the name of it, but there's a Facebook page,
And there's a WordPress site also for these Teachers of Conscience letters, where there are four teachers out in Washington State who took a principled stance and have come out to oppose the test. So this is, you know, we're connecting with them. It's all through Living in Dialogue, and Anthony Cody is putting us together with some people out there. But to kind of grow this grassroots, and it's not about us really pushing it on people, but people feeling empowered to form these groups locally so that they can use what is, you know, matters to them or what is relevant to their school communities and making such decisions. So
let me sum up something. A few months back, doing a show with Peggy Robinson and Seresta Smith and Susan Bowles, I think it is, out of Florida, she had just refused to give her kindergartners the test.
Mm-hmm.
In our discussion, we were talking about the perceived harm that she and other teachers, and that's why she took the stance that she did. And I said something along the lines of, what you did was apply a 2,000-plus-year-old principle to teachers, and that is the Hippocratic Oath of do no harm.
Right.
And I went on to say that by her taking that stance, that's a moral stance.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors, back from beginning, the principle of if a patient comes to you in X condition, please don't let that patient leave in Y condition worse off than when it came to you. That's to do no harm. And the parallel to that in terms of being a teacher is that if your practice that are being forced upon you result in you being an instrument in the harming of the children that are in your care, creating a tremendous moral conflict here, and that evoking the Hippocratic Oath for teachers, to me, was a very legitimate stance.
Mm-hmm.
Later, not in that conversation, but later, this question of Teachers of Conscience. So are we talking the same thing here, the Teachers of Conscience versus my notion of the applicability of do no harm from the Hippocratic Oath?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're definitely the same. It's the same. If you think back on the history of our country, we're riddled with really bad policy. And, you know, just to say, you know, Jim Crow laws, they were commonplace. People took them for what, you know, they were just like, you know, walking down the street. Those were really bad policies. It took people taking a principled stance against them because it was causing harm to people. Thank you. There is a time when you have to take that stand because there's no other option. The long-term option of not taking a stand, right, is going to have far worse implications for you and whatever fear that you think you have right in the moment of you know, not wanting to, whatever's holding you back. So there's definitely...
That comes right back to what Lucy said in terms of that statement that you made that stood out so powerfully for her. So we've come full circle in this. Okay,
yeah,
we have run out of time, and so I'm going to have to say adieu. But let me just say this very quickly. For most of this month, we're going to have conversations with groups that have not had opportunities to get their voices heard. We're going to talk to more high school students from student unions. We're going to start talking to college students who are social activists. And I'm reaching out to the retirees, the thousands, the hundreds of thousands, millions of retirees. I'm going to try and get all of those in this month. And one other population that I probably won't be able to get in this month is going back over to Europe to Mary Compton and bringing us closer to being able to share what's going on a global basis. We got a full month ahead, and coming to the weekly format, I think it's going to be very exciting for us. A lot of work to be done in a short time to prepare for each show, but we're up to the challenge, and I really can't wait. So
that's exciting.
With that,
thank
I'm going to say, Gia, thank you for being our guest, and I definitely want you back as often as your schedule will permit. You have a standing invitation to come back. You can even call and say, I want to talk about X, and we'll see about getting it done, okay?
Thank you so much.
I haven't done that.
I appreciate it.
I have never offered that type of platform to anyone other than you. You're the first. Okay, before
honored.
Leaving,
Emily.
Lucy, are you still here?
I most certainly am, James.
Thank you for coming in and conducting your interview. And with that, I'm going to say goodbye and have a good Sunday, everyone. And hopefully this coming week will be fine to everyone's liking. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye. Thank you. Goodbye.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.